We believe these things for a reason, and we think that they're actually helpful in the actual world, which means not just Sunday school, but hope for the institutions of our time that are a bit wavering, a bit struggling, a bit challenged.
On In Good Faith, we believe that all faith traditions have something to teach us about how God is working in the world and in our lives. So join us as we listen and learn. My town has a place they call the Food and Care Coalition, and you can volunteer to help serve meals to people, clean tables, etc. But my favorite thing about it are the days when it's not just one congregation or another that's providing the volunteer staff. When you're elbow to elbow with, say, a Seventh-day Adventist and a Muslim, it's a great time to realize how we can solve problems together when we, as religious communities, work together. My guest today is Josh Good, who talks about how to change society for good, little by little, as religious people working together. Josh Good directs the Aspen Institute's Religion and Society program and has led Faith Angle Forum, a program that strengthens reporting and commentary on how religious believers, religious convictions, and moral arguments affect American politics and public life. His writing has been published by Routledge Press, In the Hill, National Review, Deseret News, and The American.
Aspen's an amazing place, founded in 1953 in the wake of World War II to try to help society become more just and more equitable. And it really was the combination of a number of business leaders thinking about post-Germany, post-America, post-West, and people who were trying to fit together spirituality and the purpose of things, a future of security. We have a large security forum, very good at getting, as it were, a Madeleine Albright, a Henry Kissinger, and a Condi Rice in the same room. But besides that, there's a large climate forum and an economic development forum. There are 37 public programs that are public policy related in some way under the Aspen rubric, which has got a budget of about $265 million today and has about 600 staff people working not only in the United States, but now in 14 other total countries.
So what is it that makes the Aspen Institute want to be involved in religion and society? How do they see that strengthening public life?
We're less than 1% of Aspen's budget, so we're a small program, really. We have a program that really tries to serve journalists and help journalists think about the role of religion in society. We also have a religion fellows program that supports people who are experts in climate and anti-polarization and racial justice and religion, people who are journalists, people who are clerics, so two of each, 10 fellows who are beginning a program and a curriculum that sort of reinforces the ideals of equitable public pluralism. And we have a program for people who are working in the philanthropic space and thinking about religion and religious pluralism as well, how they can work together better. So I guess that's a long way of saying we're a small part of Aspen, but there is a recognition that faith and spirituality, these questions amongst people who have no faith at all, people who are deeply religious, can and often do well to consider how the role of religion in society, the world's a very religious place after all, can work with the grain of those realities.
So why create a fellowship for journalists?
Our conviction is that journalists who recognize that religion is always in the room have a leg up on journalists who don't. That's true of boardrooms, that's true of cabinet level meetings, that's true of schools, that's true of all sorts of places. And so if you recognize the ways in which religion is in play, and it usually is in play under the waterline even, that helps write a better, more nuanced, more accurate story. So we're very interested typically in convening topics like AI and religion or race and religion, topics like religion and foreign policy, topics like religion and the screens we carry around with us. How is it that religion is an indirect aspect of contemporary issues? And with a wonderful little brain trust of some wonderful journalists, public intellectuals, columnists, editors, reporters, helping to hold up topics where that would be useful. We try to draw that out, religion as an aspect of things, as opposed to the only story.
And if I could just dig in personally a little bit, I looked up Covenant College, where you attended. Oh my goodness, the most gorgeous setting up on a cliff, Stone Mountain, Georgia. And I thought, that looks like where I want to go on a vacation. I'm sure it didn't feel like one for you as a student, but Tell me about choosing a college that has a religious orientation like that. What did that mean to you? And what did that develop spiritually in you?
Thank you so much for that question. Yeah, I mean, it made an MLK speech, you know, the I Have a Dream speech. Lookout Mountain to the hills of Tennessee is a beautiful setting. Sometimes the clouds would sit in the valley, and so you'd be looking over them from this old Carter Hall converted hotel that became a school for 1,000 people or so, and rooted in the Reformed tradition. It was very particular. It wasn't my plan. I meant to go to the Naval Academy and was lucky enough to get in and decided to go to Covenant College instead, and it was just a wonderful experience. I think in some ways, going to a Christian college, there are, what, 140 or so in the CCCU today, mm-hmm. going to a Mormon school, going to a religiously Catholic college today, you're more like connected to people in medieval civilization than you are to your contemporaries at UVA, you know, University of Maryland, University of California. So I think it's a different place that you're accessing. Truth is more coherent. You're sense of it anyway. Oftentimes there are accountability groups, friendship groups that are very helpful and thick and constructive. You have a kind of a clear point of view when you leave, and you need to go learn how big the world is and how pluralistic the world is and how diverse the world is. But you have a leg to stand on. To me, there's a nice phrase that the columnist David Brooks uses, that you want to have a stable base, a secure base from which you can take daring exploits. And so if you're lucky enough to go to one of the small religious schools like Covenant, you get a little bit of that.
That's beautifully described, both by you and David Brooks. I think I heard it said once that, like a compass, when you draw, you have a fixed leg, and then you can decide how big the circle is. I love that. Expeditions, love that. Yes. Explorations. I'm gonna get to pluralism in just a minute, but just to ask you what your faith background was that an assumption as a child for you that there was a God, he was involved in your life? And was there a point at which you had to decide and commit and decide, is this real, what I've been taught?
Yes. My parents didn't come from generations of faith. They had a story of converting at a little place called Le Brie in Switzerland, where people were able to ask honest questions and look for honest answers. And my father came from a little bit wealthier mainline background and had to decide for himself. And that affected, I think, our family a good bit. He's a Christian counselor today. And yes, I think that all of us have to figure that out as we go. And to me, I just remember in my 20s, a disappointment with one job and the sense of uncertainty with that and the sense of ickiness with the world. And it had to become real to me later on and has been incredibly helpful to find Christian fellowship, a decent church and support along that line that can hopefully be part of that sense of daring exploits that we are invited into.
I always wonder, because we take circuitous routes to where we end up, often not where we thought we were headed. Even just looking back, you're still a relatively young man. Do you feel guided, or like maybe there was some guiding hand, to use the word of the founding fathers, getting you where you are right now?
Yeah, I mean, I like listening to Hamilton just as much as anybody else. That sense of little divine nudge you get. It depends a little bit on the granola you eat that day, or whether you got a bicycle ride or not, I think, you know, for whether you sort of really feel that or not. A bit of both. But I'm lucky to have married a Harvard chaplain who was a wonderful thinker in her own right and helps keep our family on the straight and narrow. We're involved in an Anglican local church and we're sticking at it. We find lots of joy from local friendships. We live less than a mile from our parish church. And I think this town, especially DC's, got unique winds, just like New York does, just like Silicon Valley, just like Los Angeles does, it's like a lot of other places in the country that do shape culture. DC is prone to the comings and goings of power. And of course, you know, famously parties where you look for the more important person in the room. And to have steady friendships with the same group of people, maybe sometimes boring friendships that you keep up over time, I think help us a lot in terms of the sort of Christian fellowship, spiritual overflow. So that's how we see the work of getting along and the work of being able to keep steady, even when there's lots of wind blowing in Washington.
I personally am very grateful for the people who tolerate my boring friendship and keep me in their circles over time. You talked about pluralism, and could you just define that for a minute? And then I'd like to dig into that.
Sure. Pluralism is just the fact of religious diversity. The world is a very diverse place. 1.9 billion Muslims in the world, 2.3 billion Christians in the world, 500 million Hindus, and on it goes. You know, we're a very religious country as well. The numbers are all over the place. They've changed, but we know that still north of 8 in 10 people believe in God, even if there used to be 71% engagement in a religious community, and now 48%. But pluralism is just a fact. Sociological, religious, political, and certainly religious pluralism is.
That seems so obvious when you say pluralism is the fact that. So it's not really something anyone can debate. It's like we live in a world where we are different. We've been raised differently, have different traditions. Part of the religion and society program there at the Aspen Institute is the Powering Pluralism Network. So if I can quote from your own website, which you're more familiar with than me, but we can solve the challenges we face more effectively than we could do so on our own. Having a strong, diverse, and connected network of leaders will provide the foundation for a thriving religious pluralism. What is your outreach and what leaders are you trying to connect with? And what do you hope those leaders will learn or be able to do in whatever their organizations are?
Yes. I had a little season of working for a wealthy benefactor whose conviction was that networks are the way society culture changes. Mm. And without networks, they just don't change. You can be a lone ranger and you can have the best ideas in the world and you stand athwart history. You won't do anything, really. Societies change by little groups of people working together over 20-year increments or 30-year increments. And if you do that over a 30-year increment and you include not only people who are in public policy, people who are in journalism, people who are in religion, people who are in the funding world is very important. Part of it that you can move things just a little bit. And if you could move things even a half an inch after 30 years, that could make a wonderful contribution to future generations is the idea of going slow. So I think our conviction following, you know, that model of Hannah More, Wilberforce, these politicians in England who changed slavery, is that if you have one big thing like a hedgehog that you pursue over time, and you do that with a group of people, and you think of your funders being part of that community alongside people who have the power of the pen, people who have positions of political leadership, people who are movie makers, etc., various sort of changing groups, clerics as well, that you can actually just a little bit move history. To me, the big thing is the idea of reminding secular elites that religion is, that it's in the room, that it's real, that it's not just a joke, that it's not just a people being hoodwinked and giving over their money, that spiritual religion is authentically present. And there's good religion and there's bad religion, but that we should do a better job understanding it because it is a major motivator for people who fundamentally have a spiritual shape to their soul, to their personhood. And so I think our goal is to highlight the reality of religious pluralism and really learn, especially in these times, that the sort of example of creative exilic minorities, of Orthodox Jews and Seventh-day Adventists, people who are part of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, people who are part of small communities, not big hegemonically privileged communities, but the small communities who deal with the reality of pluralism from the very beginning, have something to teach us, have something to teach us all about thick faith, about enduring faith, in a way that is constructive and helpful and could be an example. John Rausch has a wonderful new book out called Cross Purposes, Christianity's Broken Bargain with Democracy. And he, in short, argues that thick Christianity allows for difference with others and makes the case creatively, proactively, positively, with honesty and charity, knowing that compromise and negotiation is an inherent part of life in a democracy, not something we should have to put up with, not something we should eschew.
You've triggered so many thoughts in my mind. This is probably why you're good at doing what you do. My wife and I were speaking with my adult daughter, and she's an activist for certain causes that are meaningful to her. And I asked her, I said, how do you not be so discouraged? Like you're just pushing against a gigantic mountain. And she said, Dad, if you can get 3% of the population to act together, that can affect change. What do you think of that?
I love that. It doesn't assume the hubris that we can change a society overnight. All we really need is a small group of happy warriors, a small group of like-minded individuals who want to do something together. And I guess I think a little bit that way about some of the journalists I've been so lucky to get to know the last 6 or 7 years. It just takes a small group that kind of copy an example or two and running with it and doing with it. 3% of the population, that's a lot of people. We live in a country of 330 million people. That's a lot of people. I think great change is typically made by small groups copying one example actively. Look at the story of the religious church, but also look at examples that have caught on in the culture and eventually made a difference.
I made the mistake recently of letting my eyes linger in the comment section of an op-ed, which is always dangerous because it can torpedo your faith in your fellow citizens. And then you realize, okay, they're probably nicer in person. All of these things I'm telling myself, but someone said, these people come from Middle Eastern countries and they don't acclimate. And I said, what do you mean? And they said, we're a Christian country and they should acclimate, meaning they should all convert. And my question to them was, if you move to Saudi Arabia, then you feel that you should become Muslim, right? I was blocked. I love what you're aiming at, because just acknowledging other people, reaching out, and even learning, if you live as a minority in a society, for instance, if I were a Seventh-day Adventist and my boss always gives me Sunday off, great, but my worship day is Saturday. That doesn't really help. And if I'm Jewish and I want to go to synagogue on Friday night, Saturday morning. And so just being aware that people may be in positions where just the society itself has adjusted for the majority and left very little leeway. How do we fix that?
Yes,
You're the expert. So.
No, not the expert. I think we just have to learn to see more of one another and admit that there are great benefits from pluralism. It's nice, for one thing, to have the privilege of food that is made by people of diverse backgrounds. My friend Eboo Patel likes to talk about the potluck.
Yeah.
It's better because people bring their own cultural narrative, story, history, and gift to give to the culture. We do have to figure out how to do it. And obviously, we're going to be working on that for the next 4 years. People do need to be part of the shared experience, shared country, right? Not just have expectations to not change a thing. But there is a way through. To me, it's the pattern in the Bible that talks about the rain falling on the just and the unjust alike, or the wheat and the tares being mixed together. This is the stage of history that we're living in. It can be beautiful if we only will see the whole person.
Do you have stories of someone who's doing it well, or even just an example of where you've seen someone realize this, have the light bulb go on?
I did a degree at Harvard University in religion and policymaking, and it really was quite something to regularly interact with people who brought backgrounds that could be Zoroastrian or Hindu or Buddhist or Muslim or mainline Protestant or Catholic. I think there is something quite valuable and initially challenging, especially depending on your story, to acclimate to. But when someone becomes a friend, it's a game changer. And I think, you know, in Washington think tanks today, the sort of norms are to honor diversity in a certain way. That's just the sort of expectation. And only in deeper relationship does that sort of glib hat tip to people of diverse backgrounds become something substantive and real. So I guess my story would probably be, I worked for 3 years on a prisoner reentry initiative in Philadelphia, national project with support from Casey and Ford and the Labor Department, Justice Department. And it was a big $27 million project, and we traveled all over the country. And I was the only white guy on staff. And the learning of 3 years was just a gift that far exceeded any salary.
So that key of, you said learning and you said friend, becoming friends with people who are different than yourself. I'm drawing that as a key thing.
Yes. Yes. That takes time.
You're training leaders. You're having discussions with leaders. How do we move interfaith work, for instance, from something that leaders know about and do? How does that filter down a level into the organizations themselves? Some of that is maybe the example of the leaders, or what else happens that can help foster that?
Yeah, Aspen has this real effort underway right now to foster social trust. And it's really hard. Trust is down. It's down drastically in journalism, in television journalism, the worst, and in print journalism. But it's down in the Supreme Court. It's 9% in Congress. It's awful, really.
Yeah.
Trust in religion in general. So we're living in a time of iPhones and smart screens and little rectangles. Glowing rectangles, but we don't have trust in our neighbors, and we in some ways don't need to see our neighbors. So how does that get built up at the lower level beyond just leaders? More people inviting to dinner, but also more activities across traditions, activities across faith traditions. Normally, when people come to this building in Washington, D.C., there are a blend of activities, some lecturing, some speaking with public intellectuals, and that's great. But nobody really comes to hear the speaker speak. You come to engage. You come to work together in some way. And so I think our goal is to foster sustained contact with people over time. We have 3 in-person gatherings over 18 months for our Aspen Religion Fellows. We have opportunities at Faith Angle gatherings for people to take a walk and take a break and not just hear the speaker alone, compare notes, go file a story. I think it comes down to the sort of shoulder to shoulder opportunities that are teed up. And those are harder when people already have their set plan. And if you lock yourself in a room with the door locked from the inside, it never works. You gotta open up.
Lock yourself in the room means one thing. With the door locked from the inside, that adds a whole other interpretation and way of thinking. I'm so pleased with what you said and the ideas that it can give to me and to anyone listening about just reaching out, because I've seen just on Facebook in my area, invitations from like the Utah Islamic Center saying, come to our iftar this evening. We'd love to host you and tell you what we do and break our fast. And how hard is it to go and let someone feed you? And yet it's an effort that you've perhaps never made before. And having done that, I have these lovely friends who not only did I see that, but they emailed me and said, you're coming, aren't you? We hope you're coming. Well, of course I'm coming. And it seems like opportunities are there if we look for them.
Yes. Yeah, I want to become a person with the temperament to look for them. A friend of ours tells this great story from Michigan about starting grad school on 9/11 and the uncertainty about whether or not she and her husband should go to the mosque or not. And they did, and they were stunned to see the parking lot the next day reinforced by just way more cars than normal. And it turns out this, I think it was a black church across the street, knew of this sort of vulnerability and need and showed up for them and helped make it very safe and so forth. They're examples of this. We do have to look for them, and they tend to push against the weight of name calling and despair and nasty comments, but I think they are probably all around us. And I think they're more important at certain times also. And it strikes me that now, if there is a little bit more fear and a little more boxing out that can happen right now, is a great time to cultivate, subvert the dominant paradigm, and to cultivate the exact opposite with hospitality.
It's almost like the Good Samaritan, hospitality to the stranger there. It's beautiful. Josh, I'm wondering if you don't mind, if you look back on your journey, your own faith journey, and I know it will tie in with the work and what you pursue, but what do you think you know about God or faith now that you didn't 20 years ago?
I think that there is a sense of God being more like a mountain or an ocean, a God being more like a galactic star structure, galaxy, the bigness and the enduringness. We sometimes say we have 3 kids, 2 going to Yale and 1 going to jail. And one of our kids is a little bit more work than the other 2. And so then she's a little testing, and we're doing the best we can to be supportive. And it's stretching, honestly, and a sense of God's endurance through all things and into the eternal future. That seems to be coming loud in our ears these days a little bit, honestly, because some parts of life are a little bit more struggle and worth persevering.
Worth persevering. We thought we had 3 headed to Yale and 1 to jail, and it turns out that one's doing just fine.
That's great. That's fine. The word. That's the word for me.
Yeah, but it was our chance to lean not unto our own understanding, definitely.
Yes.
You mentioned the Anglican community that you're part of. And when I go to those services, I see the tradition of the liturgy, the coming around the year, and the joy of that. I hear some really great music sung in a lovely space. And what are the things about your tradition that bring you joy or make you feel connected to the divine?
It is lovely to have that regular repertoire anchor drumbeat of weekly services that keep you anchored and going. We are also very fortunate to be part of a church that long ago had George Washington on the vestry, has a wonderful group of people who worship together. And I'm rather close with our pastor, who's just an outstanding guy who's leading the church through just some amazing, distinct challenges from COVID and many strong political opinions in Washington to a horrific murder to an abuse crisis that happened long ago that he has been navigating. Mm. And so it's been a privilege in the sort of living institutions front to be his friend and walking alongside as he navigates those challenges. So I think any time when we aren't just passive recipients, but are active members of and have friendships that are active, religious worship becomes even richer. And that's certainly been the lucky case for me.
What does it mean to you to show up as a Christian in this world?
I think it elevates the natural decline or natural sort of steady plodding along, being faithful, or that is part of human experience, to remind us that we believe these things for a reason, and we think that they're actually helpful in the actual world, which means not just Sunday school, but hope for the institutions of our time that are a bit wavering, a bit struggling, a bit challenged. There isn't any reason for the trust in our public institutions that we experience today to be as low as they are. If you look at the last 40 years, the decline is amazing across the board, even the military. There really isn't. We live in a free society, the most advanced country in the history of the world. We're so lucky, historically speaking, to have what we do. These are facets downstream of good news, truly good news. It's in our hands to make these things better. And those of us who do believe in the promise of the divine breaking into the world are called into just an amazing invitation and story, an opportunity to make a contribution alongside that larger divine reality breaking forward and pulling us through. And so I think Christians or people who have heard the good news are really as fortunate as they come. And ideally, we enter into these challenges with vigor and joy.
Many thanks to Josh Good for speaking with me. Did you know we started a newsletter? We'll update you on behind-the-scenes extras and events. It's a great way to connect with me and the show. Sign up at ingoodfaithpodcast.org. This episode was produced by Heather Bigley. Our production team also includes Aaliyah Ebert, Katarina Martinich, and James Sturdivant. Our post-production sound designers are Mark Hansen, Ashton Parkinson, and DJ Cromarty. Find us on Instagram and Facebook at In Good Faith Podcast. In Good Faith is a production of BYU Radio. I'm Stephen Cap Perry. I hope you join me again soon, right here, In Good Faith.
Hi, I'm Stephen Cap Perry, host of In Good Faith. Nothing captivates me more than people setting out on an adventure. Especially if it's a place I wish I could go to or a subject I wish I knew more about, but I don't live in the right place or I don't have the equipment or the expertise. I'm telling you about a podcast from our BYU Radio family of podcasts, an award-winning podcast called Constant Wonder. With host Marcus Smith, you'll be expanding your horizons on all kinds of discovery. It could be science, it could be art, history, and more. Do you need that feeling of awe and wonder in your life more? I do, and I love it when I see how to experience that by hearing the stories of people who are doing and exploring all of those things that are so interesting to me. Check out the podcast, Constant Wonder,